Okay, tonight's topic that I've been assigned is the trial of Galileo, one of the great trials in the history of science because it pitted two diametrically opposed worldviews as to our place in the cosmos. Is the Earth the center of it all? Or are we a planet going around a sun? The geocentric versus the heliocentric conception of the universe. And, you know, one way to look at this is if you're out in a miles away from city lights in a dark sky, no moon, you lay on a blanket and look up at the heavens for an hour. The one thing you'd notice is the stars seem to be moving in a clockwise direction from the east to the west. And any reasonable person looking at this would conclude that the Earth is fixed and we're in the center and everything's going around us. Who would think otherwise? You know, the great early 20th century Austrian philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein said, I just think of those stupid medieval Europeans that thought the sun went around the Earth. But he said, but you know, just think how things would have looked had the sun gone around the Earth. And the fact is, it would look basically the same as what we see at night, with a couple of anomalies that we'll talk about tonight. So the structure of the solar system, you might say universe. The historical view is geocentrism, from two Greek words meaning geo or earth and center. The Earth is the center of the universe or the solar system, whereas the pre-Christian world was largely geocentric. The heliocentric view, of course, is that the sun, Helios, is the center of it all, and all the planets orbit around it. But in the pre-Christian world, for hundreds, if not thousands of years, since the dawn of human civilization, everybody, virtually, was geocentric, because that's the way it looked. It's common sense. Plato and Aristotle were both geocentrics. People were loath to disagree, especially with Aristotle's view of the solar system. So Earth is the center of a rotating universe. There were a few notable dissenters we'll look at later, such as Aristarchus of Samos in the 4th century BC, a Greek astronomer. But the greatest expression of the geocentric view was the Almagest, written by Ptolemy, who was a Hellenistic Greek living in probably Alexandria, Egypt, writing in the 2nd century AD. He wrote the great description of the geocentric model. It's hundreds of pages long. I've got a copy of it at home. And that dominated human thought for 15 centuries. We've been under the Copernican view only for about 400 years. It was not accepted until the early 17th century. So the view of Ptolemy dominated human thought for about 3 to 4 times more centuries than the Copernican view that we'll look at later. There were several proofs given of the geocentric model. Aristotle came up with a couple of simple proofs in his Physics. If you take dirt, air, and water, you pour dirt and water into a jar and shake it up, what happens? The water rises to the top, the air bubbles out, and the dirt falls to the center. Earth falls to the center, to the middle. The same thing is true with fire. Fire leaps up. It leaps away from the earth. So the Earth must be the center. And, of course, the Aristotelian view was of perfect geometric forms, especially circles. Everything had to be moving in circles, and we'll come back to that point later. Another argument for the geocentric model was the fact that Venus shows no discernible variation in luminosity. How is that possible if we live in a heliocentric solar system, in which Venus would be, at times be tens of millions of miles closer or farther, depending on what side of the sun it's on? So we don't see any discernible change in the luminosity of Venus, so that speaks against a heliocentric solar system. And then common sense, the trajectory of falling bodies. If the solar system is heliocentric, the ancients knew enough to know that we're talking about the Earth moving around the sun at some enormous distance. So our speed of revolution must be in the thousands of miles per hour. We now know it's going 67, almost 70,000 miles per hour. So if you're going 70,000 miles an hour, you know, put your hand out of your car, going 70 miles an hour in a 50-mile-an-hour zone. you know, it, you just, it almost pulls it back, doesn't it? Now, what if you're going 1,000 times faster? It's going to rip it off. How can there be, you drop, an acorn drops from a tall oak tree, and it comes straight down? How is that possible if we're going 70,000 miles an hour? It doesn't make sense. It violates common sense. Or how about Gallup polls? Did you know 20% of the population in a recent poll said that the Earth is the center of the solar system and the sun and the planets rotate around us? Boy, what does that tell you about science education? How can there be birds in the sky if it's, if we're going 70,000 miles an hour? Not to mention the rotational speed of the Earth. We're just talking about the speed of revolution around the sun. How can those birds be up there flying in formation? How can there be clouds in the sky? We're going 70,000 miles an hour and we see clouds like this? Or look at the flagpole coming in tonight. Did you see it? It's limp. How can that be possible if we're going 70,000 miles an hour? How can trees not be ruffling in the breeze? So, common sense was a powerful argument for the geocentric view. It does make incredible, it resonates with people, and it did for hundreds and hundreds of years. But the greatest proof of geocentricism was the fact that there is no observable stellar parallax. Now, parallax comes from a Greek word, paralegos, that just means joined or side by side. And so the point is this. If you take your forefinger, or your index finger, and put it on your nose, and then start blinking your eyes alternately, left and right, look at how much that finger moves, because it's so close to your baseline. But now move it at arm's length and try it. You can still see motion, but it's not that much. Now try it on my finger, several feet away. You can hardly see anything. Now what if I'm 25 trillion miles away and the nearest star? You think you're going to see parallax? Absolutely not. And so the argument was, if we're going around the sun, the Earth is going around the sun, the heliocentric view, we're going to have a baseline of millions of miles. In fact, we know it's almost 200 million miles. Think of that baseline. We should be able to see parallax in any star if it's, in fact, moving from point A to point B, 6 months apart in our orbit. But we don't. We see no parallax. And so the conclusion was, the only way to explain that is that the Earth is fixed and immovable, and there is no parallax. Of course, there was another option that wasn't considered, and that is the stars are such an unimaginable distance away that we can't see the parallax, which, of course, turned out to be the case. We didn't actually see the first parallax. It was about, we'll look at this later, I think it was 1848, Cygnus 61. Was the first star for which parallax was actually measured, and we'll look at that in a minute. Here's another argument. We've talked about Venus. Why is it essentially the same brightness all through the year if we're in a heliocentric solar system where at times it's tens of millions of miles closer or farther away from us? Well, how come it looks that that can't be? Well, there were problems. Those were the proofs of geocentricism. They were powerful. Based on common sense, and as we'll see, based on Scripture, because the church embraced the Ptolemaic geocentric system for reasons that we'll point out here in a moment. But so common sense, Scripture, observation, and then there were problems, such as, how do you explain retrograde motion of the planets? The ancients knew, looking at the heavens, that all the stars moved like star like diamonds embedded on a crystalline sphere, all moving in tandem across the sky. No variation from life to life. Orion, Sagittarius, they always looked exactly the same. Those groupings of stars didn't change. But observers noticed in the distant past that, yes, that was true, but there were a couple of anomalies. There were five of these stars that were given the names Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, that, yes, they at times moved in that same apparent motion of east to west with very little variation, but there were times when they stopped and started going in the opposite direction, retrograde motion. How in the world is that to be explained? Retrograde motion of the planets. They gave those planets the name in Greek, planetes, which means wanderer, Because indeed, if you study the heavens, you see those planets, those five planets, those wanderers that wander back and forth and are just so different from all the other stars. And it turns out that Mars retrogrades 72 days out of every 26 months. Jupiter retrogrades 121 days every 13 months, about every year. Saturn, 138 days every 12 months. Think of that. 138 days every year, Saturn is going in the wrong direction. Or Uranus, 151 days every year. Or Neptune, 158 days of retrograde motion every 12 months. Of course, the ancients didn't see Uranus or Neptune, and but they did see the first three here, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, and noticed this enormous retrograde motion. That was a problem for the Ptolemaic system, the geocentrics. How do you explain this? And, well, it turned out that Ptolemy spends quite a bit of time in the Almagest to this issue. And he comes up with the concept of epicycles, the Aristotelian concept of perfect circles. And he said that the Earth, of course, is the center of he used the term universe, and that all the planets and the stars rotate around us. And you look at the blue circle there representing our planet's orbit around the Earth, such as Mars, and it is actually moving in a perfect circle around an imaginary point. That circular orbit around that imaginary point he called the epicycle. So as the planet orbits the Earth, it's constantly going around that center, that imaginary point, in a circular motion, and that's what gives the appearance of retrograde motion. And it satisfies Aristotle. Of course, it's totally absurd, because if this were the case, it would be continuous all through the year. And it would be very short periods of retrograde motion, given the size of that epicycle. It didn't make a lot of sense, but that's the best that Ptolemy could come up with. And in fact, it becomes very complicated when you draw this out with a computer, and it looks something like this. And so it violates Occam's razor, that powerful logical principle. The simplest answer is usually correct. Is this simple? It became a nightmare of complexity, like Newton said about describing the moon's orbit. It made his brain tired. And then the Tychonian model was proposed by Tycho Brahe. He conceded that all the planets did, and the stars did, orbit the sun. So that part of the heliocentric model was right. But the sun orbited the Earth, which was fixed and immovable and in the center. The church latched onto this, and it had a great deal of support from the Catholic Church in the 16th century, 17th and 18th century. From the beginning, the church adopted the Ptolemaic system in the 2nd century AD, scriptural basis for it. When you look at various verses of scripture that the Catholic Church based this on, they looked at verses in the Bible to talk about the fact that the sun moves. And there's many. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The motion of the sun, it's not fixed and in the middle. As the sun was setting, Abram fell into a deep sleep. The moon marks off the seasons. The sun knows when to go down. And on it goes. Generations come, generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. And then there are many verses in Scripture that talk about the immovability of the earth, that the earth is fixed. The world is firmly established, Psalms 93:1. It cannot be moved. Psalms 104, he set the earth on its foundations. It can never be moved. Psalms 96:10, the world is firmly established. It cannot be moved. Same in 1 Chronicles 16. So you have these verses, many, many verses in the Bible, talk about the sun moving and the earth being fixed. It's a perfect illustration of the geocentric model. So the church said not only common sense undergirds the geocentric model, but so does Scripture itself. Well, let's talk about the heliocentric model, the contender for primacy in terms of our place in the universe, in the cosmos. And as I said before, Aristarchus of Samos in the 3rd and 4th century B.C., Greek astronomer, he wrote a book on the heliocentric theory that unfortunately doesn't survive, explaining that the sun is the center of the solar system. He did say that there's no stellar parallax observed because the stars are so far away. He was absolutely right. That was his intuition. He's referred to by Archimedes, even though nothing that Aristarchus wrote has survived. And here's what Archimedes says about him. His hypotheses are that the fixed stars on the sun remain unmoved, that the earth revolves around the sun on the circumference of a circle, the sun lying in the middle of the orbit, and that the sphere of fixed stars situated about the center as the sun is so great that the circle in which he supposes the earth to revolve bears such a proportion to the distance of the fixed stars as the center of the sphere bears to its surface. Well, let's go ahead and introduce the key player in the heliocentric theory, and that would be Nicholas Copernicus. A true Renaissance man born in 1473, dies in 1543, and a Polish mathematician. He served in many capacities, a physician, an economist, a judge, a political leader, a military leader, diplomat, economist, one of the most famous mathematicians of his day. Astronomy was a hobby. He achieved a doctorate in canon law, and he was involved in the Fifth Lateran Council of the Catholic Church to improve the calendar, because it became obvious that the Julian calendar, that dates back to the time of Julius Caesar, here we're 15 centuries later, and there were days and days of error that encroached into that calendar. And what's the significance of that in terms of the church was that we don't know if we're celebrating holy days on the right day. So are we celebrating Easter, the holiest of holy days, on the right day? And it became obvious that we're not, much less Christmas or any other holiday. So the Lateran Council employs Copernicus to fix the calendar. He spends an exceeding amount of time attempting to do that. He concludes it's impossible. But he did really enhance his study of the heavens that helped him in formulating his view that heliocentrism is correct. He thinks about it. He doesn't want to write anything because he's afraid of the backlash from the church. But a friend of his named Rheticus convinced him to put it in writing. I've got a copy of that book at home. It's an incredible book, The Revolution of the Heavenly Bodies. He was quite tendentious in the book, strongly advocating for heliocentrism. And he was warned by a young Lutheran theologian and mathematician named Andreas Osiander, who was employed to proofread the book. And he said to the aged saint, you're going to polarize, you're going to antagonize the church. You've got to come across more tentatively. The old scientist refused to do it. And so Osiander, it's now presumed, writes a foreword to the book. There is a foreword to the book. You might read it. In which he says, well, I'm just stating what may be the case just as an intellectual curiosity. We don't know exactly if any of this is right or not. Very tentative. And because of that, it didn't engender so much controversy as Galileo would run headlong into because of Osiander's preface in all likelihood. Well, it was rejected by most scientists, the church, the Protestant leaders, and Catholic. Again, that common sense argument. How can we be moving at 70,000 miles an hour? It doesn't make sense. That resonated with people. That's why to this day, 20% of the population can't buy it. We got our work cut out, Dale. We got to do a lot more open houses, don't we? Now, listen to this. I love this quote. I read this to my astronomy class every year. This is right out of book one in De Revolutionibus. This could be the theme of our website. This ought to be on our website for the club. Among the many and varied literary and artistic studies upon which the natural talents of man are nourished, I think that those above all should be embraced and pursued with the most loving care, which have to do with things that are very beautiful and worthy of knowledge. Such studies are those which deal with the course of the stars, their magnitudes, distances, rising, settings, the causes of the other appearances in the heavens. For what could be more beautiful than the heavens, which contain all beautiful things? So if the worth of the arts were measured by the matter with which they deal, this art, which some call astronomy, would be by far the most outstanding. This art, which is, as it were, the head of all the liberal arts and the one most worthy of a man, leans upon nearly all the other branches of mathematics, geometry, optics, mechanics, and whatever others, all offer themselves in its service. The divine psalmist surely did not say gratuitously, that he took pleasure in the works of God and rejoiced in the works of his hands, unless by means of these things we are transported to the contemplation of the highest good. Listen to this. Here's the seven principles of Copernican theory that you can extricate from his book. Number one, there is no one center in the solar system. He used the term universe. I'm using the term solar system. The Earth's center is not the center of the solar system. The center of the solar system is near the sun. Look at that. It's near the sun. It's not the sun, as we now know, because of Kepler. It's the elliptical orbits, and the center of gravity is not within the circumference of the sun for Jupiter. It is for the other planets. And that's why we have a wobble. And that's one of the ways we detect extrasolar planets. The distance from the Earth to the sun is imperceptible compared with the distance to the stars. Was this guy brilliant or what? Let me stop right here. I rarely, if ever, engage in exaggeration, and never in hero worship. But on this occasion, I'm suspending both rules. This guy was awesome. In fact, one of the great accomplishments in the history of human endeavor was the Copernican Revolution. You go out in the country and look at those stars and tell me that the Earth isn't fixed. And if you want to tell me that it's not, prove it. You couldn't do it, most people. Even if they believe in the heliocentric, prove it. They couldn't do it. This guy took what is apparent to any sensible person and has been for thousands of years and said, you are totally mistaken. It's not at all the way things look. I'm giving you a completely different paradigm. This was not Chronos. This was Kairos, the two great words for time in Greek. Chronos, just the passage of time quantitatively, and Kairos, the passage of time qualitatively. It's the brilliant insight that occasionally befalls gifted individuals. And that's what happened here. That he, I thought about this countless times. How did Copernicus do it? Eventually we would have figured it out. But he was the first one to do it in a systematic way. To take what is to any person the most sensible and rational explanation of what's happening and say it's all wrong. Without a telescope, he couldn't prove it. It was all mathematical and theoretical. People laughed at him and said it's absurd and it's contrary to scripture. And he did it anyway. And he was absolutely right. The rotation of the Earth accounts for the apparent daily rotation of the stars. Absolutely right. Look at the insights of this guy. The apparent annual cycle of movements of the sun is caused by the Earth moving around it. And the apparent retrograde motion of the planets is caused by the motion of the Earth from which one observes. Absolutely right, as we'll see. This guy was brilliant. Look at these points. All seven of them are right. Laughed at, mocked, ridiculed, rejected, dies on his deathbed. The day the book was published, he gets a copy. He's too feeble. His eyes are too dim to read Osiander's scandalous foreword. He dies in peace. And so here's the Copernican idea. Now, how did he explain retrograde motion? Just what we read. It's all because of the relative motion of the Earth and an outer planet, a superior planet, one that's farther away from us. To him, that would be Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. And the reason is, the closer you are to the sun, according to Kepler's second and third laws of planetary motion, the faster you're going. And so the farther out you are, in this case Mars, the slower you're going. And so we lap Mars. And how Mars looks to us in the sky, based on where we are in relation to where it is, we see the retrograde motion. And that's exactly what's happening. He explains it much better than those millions of circles that Ptolemy had to come up with. Which is the simpler solution? Copernican theory, 1543, initially ignored by the church. It was a novelty, but it's too counterintuitive to be given much sense or credence until Galileo latches onto it about 60 years later. And to that story, we now turn. 1564, Galileo's born, the same year as William Shakespeare, the same year that Michelangelo dies. By the way, Galileo dies in the same year that who was born? Isaac Newton. There's some controversy over when Newton was actually born. It may have been a year off, but it's close to the same year. Italian scientist invented some of the first telescopes. Yes, he invented the first telescope. Yeah, what about those Dutch opticians? Well, there were two, probably one, that actually invented a telescope. Keep in mind, the Greek word for telescope means seeing something far away. So that can be looking at a tree. But we know that Galileo was the first person to use a telescope to look at the heavens. And that's how we define the term telescope. It doesn't mean looking at the heavens. It just means looking at something far away. But what's farther away than the stars? And so, but there was at least one Dutch optician probably a year earlier that invented what we might call a spyglass. But he didn't use it for astronomical observations that we know of. So Galileo invents some telescopes, 3-power, 9-power, and then ultimately a 30-power in 1609. And he uses his telescope to conclusively prove the Copernican heliocentric model. How does he do it? Oh, by the way, he was a heliocentrist before he invented the telescope in 1609. Here's a letter that survived in 1597, over 10 years before he invents the telescope, to Johannes Kepler. And here's what he says. Like you, I accepted the Copernican position years ago and discovered from thence the causes of many natural effects which are doubtless inexplicable by the current theories. I have written up many of my reasons and refutations on the subject. I would dare publish my thoughts if there were many like you, but since there are not, I shall forbear. 1597. He doesn't write his great work, A Dialogue on the Two Worldly Systems, until 1632. So this is 35 years before that. He is keeping his views to himself. But he says, I accepted the Copernican position like you, Kepler. How come Kepler not got into trouble with the church? He wrote the three laws of planetary motion. The first one says all planets orbit the sun in ellipses. I mean, why isn't that adopting Copernicus? It is, but he never contended for it. He just laid it out there and said, here's what the data seem to point to. Whereas Galileo couldn't restrain himself. He did here, and he did for about 30 years, but eventually he comes out of the box. And the reason is interesting, and we'll turn to that here in a moment. This is from his journal on one of the first nights that he turned his telescope to the heavens. It's on the start page of my website. I love it. You've all experienced this before. Beyond the faintest stars the eye can see, you will behold through the telescope a host of other stars which escape the unassisted sight, so numerous as to be almost beyond belief. You ever have that? I love to take a big telescope and just sweep, without looking for anything in particular, just sweeping the sky, especially along the Milky Way, and that infinitude of stars, too numerous to be beyond belief. You sense that same awesome wonder that Galileo did. He knew he was the first person in the history of the world that actually was seeing these things. Galileo came up with telescopic proofs of the Copernican model. And he did so in a number of ways, but these are the three primary ways he did it. Number one, the mountains on the moon and the sunspots on the sun. Number two, the phases of Venus. Number three, the moons of Jupiter. Let's dig in a little bit more here. The first thing he discovers using his telescope is the moon is not a perfect crystalline sphere, like Aristotle said. He sees sunspots on the sun. And he sees valleys and craters and mountains on the moon. This isn't a crystalline sphere. These aren't perfect spheres. Look at his own drawings of the sunspots and of the surface terrain of the moon. It was scandalous. He was attacking Aristotle. And if Aristotle was wrong with regard to this, could he not have been wrong in embracing the geocentric model? That was his point. Oh, that got under the skin of a lot of people. And then what about the phases of Venus? Yeah, the phases of Venus. That's what the geocentrics are. Yeah, that's a proof of geocentricism. Because Venus is always about the same brightness. And if it's on the other side of the sun, it's 50, 60 million miles farther away or more than when it's on this side of the sun relative to us. How come it's the same brightness or luminosity? He discovers why. He points his telescope to Venus and he's stunned. Because this is what he sees. Here's just a simple one-second picture I took. What you see is that Venus, like the moon, is in phases. Nobody had ever seen this before. And if it's in phases, that means it's orbiting the sun closer than we do. Because, in fact, anything that orbits the sun that's closer to the sun than we are is going to go through phases. And here's a simple depiction of it. So there's Venus in the yellow, and So when Venus is around in superior conjunction on the backside of the sun, the full illuminated half of Venus is visible. You'd think that would be the brightest. It's not, because it's tens of millions of miles farther away. We're on the other side of the sun. Okay, so when it starts coming around our side of the sun, we only see a crescent. But it's so much closer to us, 30 million miles instead of 150, that little bit we do see is as bright as the whole half illuminated on the other side that's 150 million miles away or whatever that number is. That's what he proves. Anything closer to the sun than you goes through phases, including a soccer ball on a field. Argument number three, the moons of Jupiter. The church argued that the earth can't be going around the sun with the moon going around us. We'd leave it behind. An object in motion can't have something orbiting around it. That's what the church taught. That's what Aristotle taught. That was a major argument in favor of the geocentric model. Galileo trains his telescope on Jupiter, and what does he see to his amazement? Something like this. He sees Jupiter and the four main satellites, which have come to be known as the Galilean satellites, because he's the first person to discover them. Here's a little better. Now, some nights you don't see all four of them. And that's what he discovered over time. Sometimes you don't see any of them. Sometimes you see four, sometimes three, sometimes two, and then they alternate sides. What's going on? And as he studied it over time in his journal, there they are, Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. He makes this diagram. This is right out of his journal. Every clear night, through the telescope, he draws the satellites, the four main satellites of Jupiter. And by studying this, he comes to the conclusion that what I am seeing is nothing less than satellites or moons of Jupiter that are orbiting around it. And we know Jupiter's moving, whether you're a geocentrist or a heliocentrist. In both theories, Jupiter is in motion. How can it have four satellites going around it? The church must be wrong. And if they can go around Jupiter, the moon can go around the earth with us going around the sun. It was a radical discovery. My daughter, when she was in fourth grade, I got this chart, copied it, and we made a chart for her. And I took her out every clear night for a month, and she drew her own Galilean satellites. That won a science fair award, putting Galileo and her chart side by side with her explanation of what was going on. There's a great experiment for novices in the astronomy club. So Galileo, he's bounding with excitement at what he's discovered. Just look at Jupiter, the moons. Doesn't that prove Copernicus was right? He takes his telescope and he starts showing people, you can look through my telescope and with your very eyes you will see Copernicus is right. He takes it to the Jesuit college in Rome and he sets it up one night in 1611. Look through it and you'll see for yourself that the universe is heliocentric. Some of them refused to look because they were confident of their knowledge of Scripture. And some of them actually did look and were persuaded. He becomes more outspoken in his views. He takes that telescope all over Italy, showing people. People were starting to wonder, this guy may be onto something. As counterintuitive, as nonsensical as it may seem, there's something to what he's saying. It was becoming too much for the church. And so in 1616, he was hauled before Cardinal Bellarmino, and he was given an admonition. Henceforward, he was a cardinal working with the Inquisition. You may not espouse or even discuss the heliocentric model on pain of trial. And so Galileo backs out. And he's silent for decades. He packs his telescope, does some at work, but he's not going around giving public displays proving the heliocentric model is correct. But then something happened in 1623. His dear friend, not Cardinal Bellarmino, but Cardinal Barberini, a dear friend of Galileo, an admirer of Galileo, becomes elected to the papacy and he becomes Pope Urban VIII. Galileo saw this as an open door for him to return to the heliocentric model and to write about it based on his discoveries with the telescope. And that's what he does. And the Pope said, friend, proceed. He gave him his blessing on two conditions. Number one, you don't advocate the heliocentric model. You just explain it, the pluses and minuses. And number two, you express my views accurately. Galileo said, fine. So he writes his book, The Dialogue Concerning the Two World Systems. It's a dialogue between two people, Salviati, the great intellectual, that constantly is repeating Copernicus and Galileo. He's wise. He's artful. He's impressive. He's astute. And then you've got Simplicio, this dunce that is representing the geocentric model. And he quotes the Pope all the time. And so people understood immediately what was going on. He is attacking the Pope. And then there was a third person that was not really part of the dialogue. He was a bystander, Sagredo. He was a noble intellectual, a nobleman. And he listens to it. And he becomes convinced that Salviati is right. And so the Pope reads this. He's shocked. He has betrayed. Well, he didn't betray him. Well, he did. He didn't follow the first edict that you not present the heliocentric. You don't advocate that. He did present the Pope's views accurately, though. And he got himself into big trouble because now he lost his most powerful defender. And the Pope hauls him before the Vatican in 1632. Now think about this. Galileo is 70 years old. It's winter. He's living in Florence. He's going to make about a one-month trip to Rome, and he begged for the trial to be in Florence. The Pope denied his request. He had to travel. It took him 27 days to get to Rome. And the Pope set up a panel of 10 cardinals to be his judges. Galileo was advised on the way by an insider. They've already made up their mind that you're guilty. That you're guilty. And so after several days of testimony, the judges rendered their sentence in three parts. Number one, Galileo was to recant his heliocentric ideas. The idea that the sun is stationary was condemned as formally heretical. Number two, he was ordered to be imprisoned. And as we'll see, the sentence was later commuted to house arrest. Number three, his book, The Dialogue, was banned, and publication of any of his works was forbidden, including any that he might write in the future. You may have heard that when the verdict was pronounced, he whispered, "Eppur si muove." It still moves. There was no reference in history to that statement for 150 years. So it's probably apocryphal that he actually said that. But here's the papal condemnation. We say, pronounce, and sentence, and declare you, Galileo, by reason of these things which have been detailed in the trial, which you've already confessed, have rendered yourself, according to this holy office, vehemently suspect of heresy, namely, of having held and believed a doctrine that is false and contrary to the divine and holy scripture, namely, that the sun is the center of the solar system and does not move from east to west, an opinion that has been declared and defined contrary to scripture, the proposition that the sun is the center of the solar system and does not move from its place is absurd and false philosophically and formally heretical because it is expressly contrary to scripture. Consequently, you have incurred all the censures and penalties enjoined and promulgated by sacred canons against such delinquents. We are willing to absolve you from them, provided with a sincere heart and unfeigned faith in our presence, you abjure, curse, and detest the said errors and heresies. We condemn you to formal imprisonment in this holy office at our pleasure. As a salutary penance, we impose on you to recite the seven penitential psalms once a week for the next 3 years, and we reserve to ourselves the power of moderating, commuting, or taking off the whole or part of said penalties and penances. Galileo is housed in the basement of this building, a building that was occupied by much of the Inquisition. Down the hall from his cell, where he is going to be condemned to live out his life, he hears the screams of people being tortured, and he thinks to himself, is this where I want to spend the rest of my life? I mean, it was a good cell for him to be in. And so he is given a deal. If you formally announce your views as heretical, we'll place you under house arrest. You're not going to have to be tortured down there. And he does. And here's his official response. Let me translate this for you. But whereas, and he's wearing a white gown of a penitent as he marches into that hall to appear before his 10 judges. And here is his recantation. Whereas I must altogether abandon the false opinion that the sun is the center of the solar system and immovable, and that the earth is not the center of the solar system and moves, I must not hold, defend, or teach in any way whatsoever, verbally or in writing, the said doctrine, after it had been notified to me that said doctrine was contrary to Scripture. Therefore, desiring to remove from the minds of your eminences and of all faithful Christians this strong suspicion, reasonably conceived against me, with sincere heart and unfeigned faith, I abjure, curse, and detest the aforesaid errors and heresies, and generally every other error and sect whatsoever contrary to said holy church. And I swear that in the future I will never again say or assert, verbally or in writing, anything that might furnish occasion for a similar suspicion regarding me, but that should I know any heretic or person suspected of heresy, I will denounce him to this holy office or to the inquisitor and ordinary of the place where I may be. His deal works. He is placed on house arrest. He's out of the basement. This is no profile in courage. A man who is willing to suffer and die for what he knew to be truth. Here's a guy that bailed on truth and the interest of his own skin. Profile and courage? I don't think so. 1633, the papal denunciation, the indefinite imprisonment. Galileo is given house arrest in exchange for his written renunciation. 1638, he's blind, and he asks the Inquisition to be freed. His request is denied. 1640, he's visited by John Milton. 1642, he dies. Newton is born. 1835, his book, The Dialogue, is taken off the Vatican's list of banned books 200 years after its publication. 1992, the Vatican admits Galileo is right. And Pope John Paul II said that he was turning the case over to the Vatican legal department, and they expected a preliminary opinion within 400 years. So the wheels of justice move slowly. So we're almost done here. The impact of the Copernican Revolution. Let's talk about what is the impact of what we're talking about here. Think about the impact of Nicholas Copernicus, bolstered by Galileo. The Earth is not the center of the universe. We're just an ordinary planet orbiting an ordinary star. The principle of mediocrity, or the Copernican principle. There's nothing special about the Earth. In fact, there are countless planets. Some probably have life. The belief in extraterrestrial life becomes common. The death knell of the geocentric theory. In 1838, Friedrich Bessel measures parallax for the first time in a star, 61 Cygni. Secondly, in the 1960s, Apollo astronauts observe with their own eyes the Earth rotating around the sun. It's kind of hard to believe in the geocentric model. Turning back to the Bible, upon which the church based its defense of geocentrism, there are verses such as Psalms 8 that really kind of express the same thing as Copernicus, that when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, the son of man that you care for him? I think of the Voyager 1, which we now know is an interstellar space, the fastest interstellar spacecraft we've ever built, launched in 1977, traveling at about 1 million miles every day for all these years, 36 years. Can you believe that? 1 million miles a day. And here it is, penetrating out into that undefined region of interstellar space. Still sending messages at 20 watts. I heard the last one. Can you send us up some hot coffee? That's a little late for that. It's 11 billion miles away. That's only almost three times the distance of Pluto. 16 light hours. NASA did send a message to it last fall to deploy its secondary antenna, which hadn't been deployed since launch. 32 hours later, they got a message back, deployed. Isn't that amazing? Think of that thing out there. The sun is barely a large star. There's nothing special about it. When it passed the orbit of Pluto, on Valentine's Day, 1990. Thanks to Carl Sagan, it opened its camera, turned around, and took one last picture of planet Earth. Right there. That little dot. And here's what Sagan said. We succeeded in taking that picture from deep space, and if you look at it, you see a dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever lived, lived out their lives. The aggregate of all our joys and sufferings, thousands of confident ideologies and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilizations, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every hopeful child, every mother and father, every inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there on a mote of dust. The Earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic drama. Think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors so that in glory and triumph they could become the momentary masters of a fraction of that dot. Think of the endless cruelties visited by the inhabitants of one corner of the dot on scarcely distinguishable inhabitants of some other corner. How frequent their misunderstandings, how eager they are to kill each other, how fervent their hatreds, our posturings, our imagined self-importance are challenged by this point of pale light. To my mind, there is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly and compassionately with one another and to preserve and cherish the only home we've ever known. The Copernican principle. We are not the center of the solar system and universe. Harlow Shapley taught us in the 1930s and 40s that we're not even the center of our galaxy. We're out on some spur of a spiral arm. There's nothing special about where we are in the galaxy. We're not even in the middle. Edwin Hubble taught us in the 1930s, our galaxy is just one out of hundreds of billions in the universe. There's nothing special about us at all. Reminds us of the psalmist, when I consider your heavens, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, the son of man, that you care for him? But let me conclude with this. As a Christian, from a Christian perspective for myself, John 3:16 comes to mind. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. So is the Copernican principle correct? Are we a nondescript, unimportant planet in the myriad of other planets in a backwater area of our galaxy, one of hundreds of billions of galaxies? Nothing special about us, the principle of mediocrity. Or is it quite a bit different than that, in the sense, and Copernicus and Galileo would both subscribe to this, by the way, that this is the one Earth that Scripture says, the one planet that God loved. And in that sense, we're special. Any questions? Okay, one last thing I want to mention is that, and I didn't refer to this before, I thought of it and I didn't. You can't really fully appreciate this controversy between the two worldviews, as Galileo called them, without understanding the backdrop that we're 100 years into the Protestant Reformation. And the Protestant Reformation was based ultimately on the principle of sola scriptura, the Bible alone is our rule of faith and practice. Not the church, not the Pope, not the teachings of the church, not the traditions of the church, but it's Scripture alone. That resonated with a lot of people. And so the Catholic Church reacted to this, that if we are tolerant of Galileo, whose view contradicts Scripture, then we're going to be accused of having a low view of inspiration of Scripture. And that's one of the reasons that the Catholic Church, many people have observed, kind of went overboard with its treatment of Galileo, just to prove to the world we have a high view of Scripture too. That is a very significant part of this story. Thank you. It's been a privilege.